All right, we'll bring the Judiciary Committee meeting to order today. I'm sorry about being late. It's 1:46, and we have Senator Wilkowski, Senator Dyson, Chair Coghill. My expectation is to have Senator McGuire here shortly. End of session, and the capital budget came out today. Everybody's going in every direction, so hopefully we can make it through some of these things. When we left last, we had House Bill 83 up, which is federal regulations, executive orders, and we had adopted version O. An amendment was given by Senator Wilkowski. Mr. Pound wanted an opportunity to give another response to it, and then we'll give the maker of the amendment an opportunity to make his case, and then we'll bring that up to a vote. Now, we've hung out long enough on that. So, Mr. Pound.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jim Pound, staff representative Keller, and as you're probably well aware, he is involved in the other side's Judiciary Committee at this time and rather busy. I have requested that the sponsor of the amendment withdraw the amendment, and I'm gathering that that is not going to be the case. Therefore, I would like to point out that you have in front of you a report that's about 6 pages long that I know at least 3 members of this committee have seen because it was requested by the Senate State Affairs Committee from the Department of Law that discusses legal actions against the federal government since 2008. Anyway, the bill sponsor still continues to consider this amendment unfriendly and unnecessary. Amendment 0.1 is simply an effort on the part of the sponsor, I believe, to delay the legislation. This bill currently in its current form is 19.
Point of order. If I wanted to delay this bill, I'd get up and walk out right now because you don't have quorum if I get up and walk out. So I take offense at that statement. It's not an attempt to delay this bill.
Yeah, and trying to read into a motive is not something I will allow. So, yeah, I appreciate the apology, but let's not read into motives of what we do here.
This amendment, we have been advised by law, does not affect the fiscal note, but it would require a change and moving the bill for concurrence in the House, which is probably unlikely, or it would happen, but was unnecessary. Also, the amendment's references, and if you look on the amendment page, you'll see under AS 44-23-0207A, there is already language that says it has to do with the work and expenditures of the office. 7 says make available a report to the legislature through the governor at each regular legislative session. And so language is having to do with expenditures should already be taken care of. The amendment language is of little concern to the members for the most part of the body. It is primarily an issue that could also be brought up during finance subcommittees under M&Ms. And I respectfully request the committee, by a roll call vote, reject this amendment.
M&Ms are missions and measures.
Yes, sir.
Just for those listening in. Senator Wilkowski.
Mr. Chair, this is a straightforward amendment. It simply asks that we, I think this is information that the Senate Judiciary Committee, probably the entire legislature should have, summarizing litigation. We're asking through this bill that we get a summary of every regulation, every executive order, every federal law that's passed. And this is simply saying, what's the state doing in response to that? It's simply asking for a summary of the litigation. It's simply asking for a discussion of the legal issues, the cost of the case, and the final disposition of the case. It's good government to have this information. Our job is to oversee the executive branch. I'm glad this is a great document. I have seen this before. It should be something that is provided to the entire legislature on a yearly basis so that we can see what's happening.
Yeah, and I'm very sympathetic to the amendment. Any other, Senator Dyson? However, I'm going to vote against the amendment based on the recommendation of the maker of the bill, and with the expectation that this issue will come back up. And I'm trying to figure out a way to get that summary of litigation in somewhere, but this one looks probably more to opinions on kind of the regulation part of it, so, and rather than the litigation, so it does and kind of enter a new element to it. I mean, notwithstanding it talks about civil actions, so I'm going to vote against it. Any other discussion on the amendment? Call a roll call vote on the amendment. That's amendment number one, true?
Yes.
Yeah, all right, got it.
Oh, we got one. Senator Dyson?
No.
Senator Willickowski?
Yes.
Senator Coghill?
No.
One yes, two no.
And I appreciate the discussion that this brought up. So, and I don't expect that conversation is going to go away, and I'll look for ways to help that conversation fold in somewhere, I think. So with that brings House Bill 83 before us. You know, the policy call is getting federal statutes, regulations, and executive orders kind of compiled and shown where those differences lie with state law. So I think that's a good idea. We've had a lot of resolutions this year that have talked about federal overreach. There are some places where probably communities could talk about state overreach too, but at least this gives us a tool to measure what's coming our way. So any other discussion on the bill? You make a motion to move it?
Yeah. Version O. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I move that we move committee substitute for House Bill 83 Judiciary. That's the / O from committee with whatever fiscal note there is and individual recommendations.
Is that objection to moving it from committee? All right, seeing no objection, we'll move House Bill 83 from committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note. And that will bring House Bill 69 before us. Last we talked about, we had version I before us. Why don't you go ahead and turn over to that? We have the sponsor before us. There's been no changes that I know of from the last meeting we had. So we'll give the prime sponsor opportunity at this point to make a final statement on this particular version. Thank you, Mr. Speaker, for showing up to our committee. Welcome, and identify yourself, and it's your floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Representative Chenault, represented for District 28 on the Kenai Peninsula. Mr. Chairman, understanding the needs of the committee and the concerns that the committee had with this particular piece of legislation, while I may not agree with the total changes in the bill before you, I do understand your concerns and the concerns expressed by the Attorney General. We still feel that it needs to be as strong a message as we can be sent to the federal government. So while I may not agree, Mr. Chairman, I understand your duties as the chairman is to try to shepherd a piece of legislation through your committee that you think will pass. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll kind of leave it at that unless my staff has a couple other things you'd like to say.
All right. Thank you for coming before the committee, and thank you for the work. We heard very vehemently support for your version, and we took a little bit of heat for some of the changes. But I still feel that these changes are important to move forward on. So, and I think at the end of the day, if your body can't agree with it, then we'll just deal with it accordingly. So, so I'd like to have a motion to move House Bill 69, version I.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I move that we move House Bill 69, committee substitute for House Bill 69 / I version from committee with individual recommendations.
Any objection to moving it forward? All right. With that.
So and attached and fiscal notes.
Attached, I think, zero fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Chairman. All right. Why don't we just take a brief at ease, and we'll wait for, I think we have Senator Mr. Gruenberg coming up here for a second, so let's just take it at ease. call the committee back to order, and we have Representative Grunberg in front of us with his staff, and we have House Bill 9, Secure Transactions, Funds, and Transfers. And so, Mr. Grunberg, why don't you go ahead and introduce the bill, how you want to lay out the information before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to thank you very much personally and the members of the committee for scheduling this bill so quickly. It is a priority of the commissioners on uniform state law, and the Department of Law strongly supports it, as they will testify. And they're most anxious to get this bill enacted because there's a date, the 1st of July of this year, which is the effective date across the country. This bill contains really two different provisions that relate to commerce in the United States. Sections 1 and 2 deal with banking law, and when Dodd-Frank was enacted at the federal level, there was a glitch in the drafting. And certain types of remittance transfers, which is a technical term and will be discussed, fell in the cracks and are not subject either to federal or state law. And what our bill here does is it states that if it's not clear where remittance transfers are covered, then by default they go to state law. And it is important because banking is so highly regulated that everybody must know the rules, and Sections 1 and 2 do that. The rest of the bill are 2010 amendments to Article 9, which is secured transactions, and they deal with several things involving basically name changes and misspellings and things like that. They enable creditors to track the debtors, sometimes who change their name and stuff, or their names may be misspelled. And basically, there's a series of identifications that they look at, and they look at the most recent identification, like a driver's license, something like that. And secondly, they'll allow the recordation of certain types of collateral in the state where the creditor organization has its home office. So it deals with technical issues that allow the perfection of securities. I mean, I'm talking about collateral, not the bonds and stuff like that, but collateral. And it is very, very important in the financial community and in the field of commerce. And once again, thank you very much. And I'm not aware of any opposition to the bill. And with that, I will sit here for a minute, and then I can get back and listen to Senator Dyson's bill.
Vote for it.
Well, when it comes up.
So Deborah Baer, Department of Law, probably should be the first one to come up here. And Deborah, thank you for taking time to come to the committee.
I'm Deborah Baer, and I'm employed by the Alaska Department of Law, and I'm chair of the Alaska Uniform Law Delegation. The Alaska statutes assign to the Department of Law the important duty of promoting uniform laws in Alaska, where uniformity among the 50 states is very important. Alaska has been a member of the Uniform Law Commission since for over 100 years. It's generally a states' rights organization where states meet every year and we discuss and propose solutions to our state legislatures for uniform solutions to common problems where uniformity is desirable. One of these areas is commerce. Businesses frequently buy and sell their products across state lines, borrow money across for the capital needs across state lines. Because of this, all states have adopted the Uniform Commercial Code to ensure reliability and predictability of these transactions. This bill is an update of two articles of the Uniform Commercial Code. Alaska has adopted the base Article 9 on secure transactions and Article 4 on funds transfer several years ago. These are just updates. And there's four major changes that I wanted to highlight for you and give you examples because you're going to find out that it happens in near everyday transactions. The first one has to deal with, as Representative Grunberg was saying, misspellings of names. When I go, my husband and I are just process of buying a new car. We just bought one. As a process of it, you sign your agreement to pay the money, and we also give the seller of the car a security interest in the car, so that if I don't pay on time, the creditor has an easy way to go get the car without having to go through a big legal hassle to get the car back. What the Uniform Law Commissioners have found is people are doing the best they can on typing out these agreements, but sometimes there are misspellings in names. So, for example, in my case, my name is Deborah Bear. Deborah can be spelled three or four different ways. Bear can be spelled three or four different ways. If, for example, the security agreement spelled it differently, that puts the creditor in a situation where we may have to have a big lawsuit over something that everybody agrees. I promised to pay the car, pay for the car. I got the car. It should be not because of a typo, something delayed when and it'll impede commerce across the states. So basically, what they're saying in misspelling of names, of individual names, you look first to get, did they get my name right? If they didn't, then you look to see whether or not they matched the name on my driver's, my state driver's license or my state ID card. If I have two driver's licenses, like a commercial driver's license and a regular driver's license, you pick the most current of those that's valid. If I have a state ID card on top of that, again, you take the most current that is valid, and that's the one that you use. And if the creditor looks at that, that's the creditor's safe harbor. And that's a protection to me, to consumers, too, because a consumer, if this doesn't move smoothly and the banker has any concern or car dealer has any concern, they won't sell a car to you. And they'll wait and make sure that all the paperwork is done correctly. But this is a safe harbor, and it's a the Uniform Law Commissioners are recommending that to you. The second change deals with a definition of registered organization. And basically, it's this, I want to give an example because it's so much easier to understand. If I was opening a bank, a small business in Anchorage, say Bears Banks, Bears Bikes, and I went in and I got a loan to buy my bikes, and I sell in Anchorage, and I also sell in Seattle, and I also sell in Washington, where do they file that security agreement? Well, this answers the question and says you look at the date where my business was formed, you look at where it was formed, and it was formed in Alaska. We go over to Department of Commerce, and that's where it's formed. And so you would file those documents in the state of Alaska, not in the state of Washington, the state of Oregon. The third problem that it addresses, it has to deal with, it's called after acquired property. And we'll take my same example of Bears Bikes, where I open my business in Anchorage. I find out that opening a bike business in Anchorage in January isn't probably a good business decision, and I decide I want to move it to Arizona. I still have the same loan. I'm buying more bike parts as I'm out of state. Where do they file that agreement? Does the agreement that attached to that, does that give the same protection to the creditor that gave me money? It gives them a four-month time when I moved to Arizona that they can rely on that filing in the state of Alaska. Those are the three changes to Article 9, and 36 states have already adopted those changes, and they're pending more in 13 jurisdictions. So that's almost the whole nation that's going to have this by July 1. The final changes are in the funds transfer, and the simplest way to explain that is when you're dealing in business, most transactions are done now by wire transfers. Very few people pull money out of or write checks. And in the process of doing these changes with Dodd-Frank, these remittance transfers generally it's unclear where they're covered. It's a very difficult area for the banking community. They like precise rules. You'll see a letter in your packet from the Alaska Banking Community saying they strongly support these changes for the predictability for people. The Article 4 changes have been passed by 14 jurisdictions and are pending now in 21 jurisdictions. There's a sectional analysis in your packet. Additionally, today I have the state recorder available by telephone to answer any questions that you may have on the filing process. Stacy Schubert is here from Alaska Housing Finance to describe the benefits this bill to the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And we're fortunate to have a national expert from the Uniform Law Commission. It's Bill Henning from Alabama. He teaches this subject. He's written books on it. So if you have any technical questions, I would love to get them today while Mr. Henning is available to us. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to try to answer them.
Any questions to start off with?
Chair, you plan on doing a walkthrough on the bill?
I could do a walkthrough, or I was intending to rely on the sectional today and allow people to testify.
let's let the testify happen today, and then that'll give us some of the concepts, and then we can go through and see them section by section later on, so that at least they're recognizable. That's kind of what I had to do to get the picture.
Okay.
So at this point, I have a couple of people here, and I got Bill Henning online. Mr. Henning, can you hear me?
Yes, I sure can.
My intention is to take testimony so that you can hear some of the discussion and questions, unless you have a time constraint.
No, I'm fine. Whatever is best for you is fine with me. That's just fine.
All right. Let's go ahead and take some of this testimony first, and that'll kind of dust off some of the questions that maybe we can get in. And if for some reason we need to go into the bill section by section, I think in order to get those kind of questions with Mr. Henning online, we may want to take the time to do that today. So I didn't think of us spending as much time on this bill as that today, but we can do that. So we have Stacy Schubert. Stacy, if you're here, this is Alaska Housing Finance, and give us your testimony, and if there's any section that you want to reference specifically, help us, and that'll help us kind of focus if need be.
Sure.
Identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman Coghill, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stacy Schubert, and I'm the Director of Government Relations and Public Affairs for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, through our multifamily lending department, utilizes Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code in securing some of its collateral when financing multifamily projects. The collateral, such as kitchen appliances, furniture, equipment, and the like, is perfected through the recording of a UCC financing statement. As proposed, House Bill 9 enhances AHFC's, as well as other creditors' secured position by providing, one, greater guidance as to the name of the debtor that is to be provided on the financing statement, and two, greater protection for an existing secured creditor having a security interest in an after-acquired property when the debtor moves to another state or merges with another entity. To offer a single example, should AHFC foreclose on a property and try to repossess and sell furniture and appliances, the amendments in House Bill 9 will protect AHFC if the debtor has merged with another entity after the loan has closed. And it's for that reason that AHFC finds value in House Bill 9, and thank you for the opportunity to provide comments. Eric Havelock is our multifamily lender, lending supervisor, and he is on the phone to answer any technical questions.
And maybe one of the technical questions should be, where is that provision precisely in this bill? Do you have that?
Not in front of me right now at this moment, sir, but I'd be happy to get it for you.
It's just that what I want to do is I want to start digging into sections so that we can identify your comments with these sections. And so who did you say was online?
Eric Havelock.
Eric, can you identify that for us?
Chairman Coghill, this is Eric Havelock. I'm the multifamily underwriting supervisor for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. The section Stacy's talking about is related to the changes to Article 9, but to the actual line item in the bill, I'd politely request that we refer to Representative Gruenberg.
All right. Okay. And that just trying to keep in keeping with the request of committee members that want to drill down through what each section does before we pass it out. So thank you very much, Deborah. I appreciate your time to come and testify. And we have Luke. Is it Farming?
Fanning.
See, you got to be careful. I'll assign new names.
Will do.
Thank Go ahead and identify yourself. Put yourself on.
Yes, there. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Luke Fanning, and I'm Vice President for First National Bank Alaska. I'm here today on behalf of the Alaska Bankers Association, which represents 8 state, national, and federal savings banks in Alaska. And our member banks are responsible for 85% of the non-public commercial lending in Alaska, as well as 2,500 employees across 130 branches statewide. The Alaska Bankers Association supports House Bill 9 because it provides for necessary amendments to Articles 4A and 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code. Article 9 has been adopted in all 50 states, and this legislation is necessary to address recent amendments to the article made in 2010. House Bill 9 also clarifies the relationship between UCC Article 4A and the Federal Electronic Funds Transfer Act, which governs electronic electronic transfers like wire transfers, and remittance accounts. The amendments to the article have already been adopted in more than 30 states, and similar legislation is pending in several others. It is important that this bill be passed this year because the amendments will be effective July 1st, 2013. If the bill is not passed this session, then Alaska will be inconsistent with the amendments adopted in the majority of the states already. The bottom line is that this bill is necessary to keep Articles 9 and 4A up to date and to ensure that Alaska law is consistent with financial practices in the rest of the country. Failure to pass the bill could result in additional costs and uncertainty for Alaska businesses and financial services customers. Thank you for your time and consideration of the Alaska Bankers Association's position on this bill.
Thank you for coming to testify, Luke. Any questions for Luke? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And then we have Paula Kelsley from DNR, and I noticed the instruction section in Section 34 deals specifically with DNR. Was there something you wanted to put on, or just are we open for questions, Paula?
I'm open for questions.
All right. Okay, we won't. I don't know that we have any at this point. I just wanted to make sure that you are specifically mentioned. So we will get to questions to you probably before this is all over. Deborah Bear, could I have you come back up here for a moment, please? I appreciate. Would you give me one more time the process to get a uniform commission law in place? There's 30-some states.
Right.
Is there a threshold that has to happen, or is it the commissioners have to come debate it within themselves, and then as we are now recommended to states,
yes.
And where is there potential for modification?
Okay. This is Deborah Bear for the record. I'm chair of the Alaska Uniform Law Delegation. We meet annually each year, all the states. We pass it after deliberation. Sometimes deliberation is many years. It's an open process. We allow everyone from the banking community, consumer groups, everyone to have an opportunity to develop the bill. Then we take it back to our state legislatures and recommend it, as I'm doing today. We are recommending, it's unusual for the Uniform Law Commissioners to recommend a particular date, but it's very important in the secure transactions that things happen on the same date, because if not, you could have an odd situation where somebody buys a product in one place and sells it another product, the security agreements in another place, and there's two different laws by the dates that control. So that's why we're recommending it to you. And this is as I say, 36 states have adopted this, and it's pending now in 13, so that's almost all states.
Okay, and then the other question I had was in the title that you mentioned, the Uniform Law Commission suggested a title change in this. Help me understand where this falls into the different segments of that Uniform Commission Code.
Okay. I'll try my best to try to answer it, but if I don't, please restate
your
question.
I may have asked it poorly, too. I'm just trying to figure out. You mentioned this as a certain article, and yeah. I want to know where it fits within articles.
Sure. These are amendments to Article 9 and Article 4A. There are other parts of the commercial code that are not before you today, like Article 2 sales. That is Amazon. You buy a book from Amazon, it's controlled by Article 2 sales, and all the states have adopted that. There's others on bulk transfers and leasing, and at this point we may have to turn into Mr. Henning to help out. But there are several articles in it, but we're only bringing two today for you that we recommend that they need updating.
All right. Mr. Henning, you heard my question. Is there any additional comment for me on that?
Just very briefly, the Uniform Commercial Code itself is developed by the Uniform Law Commission and another organization, the American Law Institute. As Ms. Bear indicated, it's a very open process. It takes years to develop these articles. But when we develop them, they're not the law. They are recommendations to the states. In the case of the Uniform Commercial Code, it has been adopted in all 50 states, and there's sort of a constant process of trying to update it and keep it current. There was a major revision of Article 9 of the UCC that became effective in all of the states at the same time on July 1, 2001, the same process of asking the states to defer effectiveness until a particular date so that everything occurred at the same time was used successfully then. And these provisions that we are discussing today are a relatively minor, I mean, they seem fairly long, but a relatively minor technical clarification, tweaking, if you will, of the major revision in 2001. I was on the drafting committee that developed this. I'm, like Ms. Baer, I'm a uniform law commissioner, was on the drafting committee that developed these, and we were limited by our charge from the Uniform Law Commission to deal only with practical problems that had emerged that were creating issues for lenders and borrowers out in the marketplace. And so one other point I would make is that one of your questions was the ability of the Alaska legislature, I think, to modify these. And the answer to that is that you are creating the law for Alaska and have full authority to modify these. That would put you out of step with other states, and so there will be consequences. But this is entirely within the sovereign rights of Alaska.
Yeah. And the reason I ask that is because we've done some compacts, and I just wanted to know how closely this tracked. And I understand that other states have put it in, so it's becomes a uniform law if it's uniform. Mm-hmm. And I understand that. So thank you very much. I think what we should do, if we could, let me see, we have quite a few sections in this bill. Let's see, how am I going to do this? If you could take about 10 minutes and give me just a 10-minute sectional,
sure.
Then at least we will get kind of the body concept, and let's go with that to start up with, and then we can back up from there.
For the record, my name is Deborah Baer, and I'm chair of the Alaska Uniform Law Delegation. I would like to suggest Mr. Henning also help me on this, because some of these you may have more technical questions than I have background to be able to answer quickly.
That would be fine.
Okay. Section 1 and 2 deal with the 4A amendments. That's the remittance transfer language that we talked about. It clearly states that the remittance transfers now will be covered under state law. And this is the language that is supported by the banking community, and you have a letter in your packet justifying that. Okay, sections 3 through 7 deal with basically definitional changes. Some of them are to bring up to date for electronic commerce, our definitions for our Uniform Electronic Transactions Act. Others are to reflect updates now where some states now use other kinds of documents for certificate of title and recognizing that there are alternatives in other states, so it's fine-tuning language. In sections 5 and 6, it recognizes that there are new business organizations in Alaska and elsewhere in the nation that are not formed under the corporation law but are formed under other processes of Alaska law, such as limited liability companies, and they recognize that they can take the advantages of this name issue, so that if you have an issue, you look at the names on record with the Secretary of State or the, in our case, it would be the Department of Commerce as to what somebody's official legal name is. On Section 8 of the bill deals with control of electronic chattel paper, and that's to demonstrate basically who owns the chattel paper and how you can figure out ownership of it. And the way I describe it to people is, if I went, instead of buying my car outright from the car dealer, I lease it, that lease document has value. Mm-hmm. Who has ownership of that lease document? This helps clarify that. I'm on page 4, section 9. This is a technical change to clearly say how where home office is, a state of its location, designating its home office and other comparable office. This used to be in the comments to the Uniform Code and now brought into the codified. Section 10, again, is a technical definitional change to certificate of title. Section 11, this is the rules that Stacy Schubert was talking about for the 4 months when I changed my location. I moved to Arizona in my example. This sets out how you figure that out, and especially if I change the name of my business organization when I move. That's all in Section 11. Section 12 is, again, a technical change to deal with that there may be states that use other kinds of documents for certificates, and that's a technical change in terms. Again, Section 13 is a technical change to more clearly recognize chattel paper, tangible documents, and goods and instruments. Section 14 deals with priority of security creditors, security interests created by a new creditor. Clearly makes up the its technical changes to protect the new priority rules set elsewhere in the bill. Sections 15 through 16 deal with secured parties' assignments of payments, and how they may use the remedies under this act. Section 17 deals again with the name changes, as I was talking about, for individuals. And for trusts, it talks out, also talks with for registered organizations. This is the name changes and how you handle that. And page 8 is the one that's had the most conversation about today, page 8, lines 11 through 25. That's where, if I'm an individual debtor, I look to the name of the debtor, I look to the driver's license, and the things that we've discussed earlier. Section 18 is, again, some changes to work with Section 17. Section 19 talks about you look at the name of the decedent, you look at if we have duplicate cards, as I was mentioning, a driver's license, a commercial driver's license, you look at the most recent, and then there's a definition that falls. Section 20 deals with technical changes for new rules on individual debtors, and it looks like a lot of word changes, but it's just to recognize that there are, when your name is insufficient, how you judge that. But the basic legal standard hasn't changed. Section 21 is more clarification requested by state filing offices, such as recording offices in the state, to say that if you have amended statements, you look at the initial statement to do certain transactions. Section 21 is a technical change to deal with when someone files a correction statement under the existing law. It may technically not be a correction, it's just additional information. So the basic initial filing is there, and then if I want to provide more information or a creditor wants to provide more information, it's to match what's going on. It's not correcting the original statement. And if you look at Section 23, it deals with, again, this concept of someone gets to, if I file an initial filing statement and I file a second statement, it's really information to provide additional information for people to consider. It doesn't technically correct the base document that is on file with the state recorder's office. Section 24 deals with filing on more on the correction statements and where they are filed. Section 26 is dealing with the applicability section. There are numerous sections in here, Section 27 through 30, dealing with transitions, because we know business transactions are happening every day of the week, and what happens when the law changes in the middle of the somebody signing an agreement, somebody filing an agreement, and this addresses to keep everybody's business expectations the way people intend them to be. Section 34 is the instructions to Department of Natural Resources, and I believe the state recorder's office can alert you that they are prepared and ready to go on July 1 to implement this. This is not going to be a surprise to them, and they have a zero fiscal note on it. And again, if you look at Section 37, the effective date is July 1, except for the instructions provision in 34 to give DNR the authority now to start acting. I'd be glad to try to answer questions, or we could have Mr. Henning fill in the blanks, if whatever your preference is, Chair.
Well, maybe you just ask Mr. Henning, was there anything that you saw in there that you wanted to make additions to, Mr. Henning?
No, Mr. Chairman. I think that was a good run-through Many, many of these provisions are just to resolve minor ambiguities, or in a number of instances, there's been a definitional change up front, and then there's a later change that sort of just works through the definition, and so there's nothing of substance going on in quite a number of these. But I think that was a good run-through, and I'd be happy to answer any specific questions.
Actually, Deborah, that was exactly what I was looking for. I needed kind of the body of thought laid out before me, and section by section. And I can tell you, the way you said it and the way I read it in the sectional, it was better to hear it from you.
Thank you.
It actually helped me. So in the transitional language, I could not figure out. It was... maybe I was going to sleep during the transitional section.
I don't know. Complex.
It is. It was a little convoluted. All right. I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to let people kind of ponder this, percolate on it. If there's any questions, obviously, as you can see from the committee, I'm having a hard time keeping everybody's attention. But my intention is not to hang on to this too long, but long enough for us to have any substantive questions. So I'm going to set the bill aside at this point. And we will bring it up probably Friday. All right?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We'll take in at ease for a second. Okay. Bring the committee back to order. Next before us is a committee substitute for Senate Bill 65, which is our trust bill. And I would move that we adopt the CS for Senate Bill number 65, version O, dated 4/2/13. That is, takes Section 37 out of the bill. Is there any objection to adopting version O as the working document for the trust bill? I can read the section to you if you wish.
Maybe if you could just explain what that section
all right.
is, Mr. Chair.
Just for the objection, Section 36, do you have that in front of you? I can get it right here.
I do.
36 or 37, let's see. I have before us in the committee here, Chad Hutchison. That was it Section 36?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay, and this deals. Oh, I'm on the wrong version here, evidently. This was 36 of the C version.
37 of the C version, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Should have been more prepared for this. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, I can read that for...
Why don't you read it? I haven't got to it yet, so go ahead and read it.
Section 37 is amending of AS 2109210M. It specifically states that the tax imposed under this section for a single life insurance policy or for a group or other type of policy that insures the life of one or more individuals shall be computed at the rate of, number one, 2.7%, of policy year premium up to $100,000, and number two, 0.1% of policy year premium exceeding $100,000. And I believe David Shaftel is online, and we have Beth Chapman with us too, who can explain what that means and why we eliminated it.
Yeah, the first policy call on eliminating it was it creates a fiscal impact that really has a an impact that at this point the maker of the bill, myself and those who are counseling me, would rather not do this year. That's the main thing, right?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, and that can be taken up in a subsequent bill at some point in time in the future.
Okay. So any objection to adopting the version without that in it? All right, so that will bring the version O before us, and there will be an attached fiscal note, which I had prepared for you, which is... on the desk today. So we have about 20 minutes before the committee ends, and my intention then is to bring this back tomorrow before us to complete the discussion and move it out. So why don't you start? There's two ways we can do this, I suppose. If you want, you can go through the sectional. I know you created a tab section, but really what we need to do is kind of look at what is the sectional approach to the bill. So if you could, are you prepared to walk through it, or do I need to get other people?
Mr. Chairman, before I do that, I'd like to address the single subject rule that was brought up
point,
in question.
Good point, yes. Why don't you go ahead and address that?
Yep, Senator Wilkowski, I brought up a legitimate question about the single subject rule that was brought up by Ledge Legal. We corresponded with Senator Wilkowski's office and sent a legal opinion that was prepared by Representative Thompson regarding HB 292, which was a substantially similar version of this bill last year. To ensure that it's got the proper vetting and that attorneys had a chance to review it, I reviewed it myself. Previously, I worked for Cushman & Gross Close in Fairbanks for 5.5 years. I went on the Westlaw database this morning and cross-referenced all the cases that were stated in the memorandum. I want to point out a few things for the committee's benefit is that the single subject rule has got, number one, broad interpretation. And number two, as long as the connection is, you know, is there's a logical connection, or if there's under a popular understanding, it generally qualifies under the single subject rule. The cases that have been taken before the Alaska Supreme Court include 8 different cases, and 7 of those 8 were deemed to have qualified because it is a broad interpretation. Examples of which, as far as the subject matter of the bill, include taxation or land. So it's a very, very broad interpretation. I believe that our bill will qualify. You can call it the trust bill. You can call it the family financial planning bill, which maybe is more apropos description of it. The one that did not qualify, the case that did not qualify, had to do with a bill that tried to include oil taxes and a clean election program. And obviously, there's no correlation between those two subject matters, and that was something the Supreme Court said that was a violation of the single subject rule. So I believe that our bill does qualify, and the majority, the entirety of the bill has to do with family financial planning matters or estate planning matters, something to that effect.
Okay. All right. I will review what the our own department put before us, and I must confess I have not read that thoroughly. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's well, I saw the opinion, and it certainly raises a question about whether or not there's a violation of the single subject rule. That's our attorneys doing it. You know, one of the things that if I were an attorney on this case, I would probably advise you to take the offending parts out. I mean, it's all about managing risk. And we're creating trust funds and dealing with people's retirement plans, and I don't fully understand the bill at this point, but I suspect there, if we're creating something that will benefit one beneficiary over another beneficiary, I know how probate cases can get, and they can get very, very ugly, and maybe there's someone online that can correct me if I'm wrong, that there wouldn't be, you know, we couldn't possibly expect some sort of a challenge here. But if there is a challenge, I can guarantee you some, and particularly if it's a lot of money involved, there's probably going to be some attorney out there who will challenge this. And so if we have the opportunity to fix it, it's about managing risk. I wouldn't want to pass a law with that cloud hovering over it. But maybe there's an attorney online who says this really isn't making big changes that wouldn't be challenged down the line.
Perhaps, Mr. Schaftel, if you could chime in.
Is Mr. Schaftel online?
Mr. Chairman, this is Dave Schaftel. I'm an attorney in private practice and testified previously on this bill. We've had the experience, it seems like every time that we've participated, we being the group of estate planning attorneys and trust officers who have been working with the legislature over the past 15 years, really, 16 years now, to improve the laws in this area. Legislative affairs, almost uniformly, every time a bill comes up, gives us these two opinions. And I've worked very closely with the attorney who's assigned to this area over all that period of time. It's always been the same attorney. And she feels that she has to bring these issues up because they're possibilities. Chad Hutchinson has explained to you the legal analysis that we've had previously, both from other sponsors and their legal assistants, the attorneys working for them. There was the same explanation made with respect to another bill from the Attorney General's office that I heard online while waiting for one of these two bills to come up, dealing with the same subject and or the same issue. And with respect to the single subject issue, the explanation has always been that the Supreme Court has looked at these and with a broad view, and if there is a relationship, has not struck down legislation. And that's been the interpretation both from Assistant Attorney General, who testified, from the attorneys who work with the legislative staff in the past. And again, it just seems to be an abundance of caution that Legislative Affairs brings this up each time. There are, you know, 17 different subjects in this bill. I'm sure you don't want to see 17 different bills. That would be impractical. There's perhaps some kind of a small business risk always that some attorney will make an argument in the future, but that's much less of a risk than the business risks or other types of ambiguities that we all have to live with every day in making things proceed. So this has not been a concern of the group of attorneys that are working with this bill. It hasn't really been a realistic concern in the past. I agree certainly with Senator Wilikowski that an attorney can make that argument, but I don't think it's a winning argument, and that's just, I think, one of the things that always can occur in the future, but should not be something requiring us to go back and have 17 different bills here for these important matters, all of which are related to family planning, to estate planning. I mean, all these matters were put in by estate planning attorneys relating to their practices and what they see coming up in their practices repetitiously in matters that need to be resolved in favor of Alaska's residents so we have better estate planning, estate trust area, estate trust legislation. So I hope that responds adequately to your concern, Senator, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, with respect to this issue.
So, David Schaftel, thanks for helping us through this. You've been working on trust laws in the state for, 16 years in this particular venue?
Mr. Chairman, with the legislature, yes.
Okay.
And that's really, I mean, actually, it's been before that. There have been other times that I've worked on legislation before 1997. I've been practicing for close to 40 years up here. But really, the group of us who began working with the legislature to improve laws in this area and just routinely doing that, thoroughly looking for ways to improve these laws, that began in 1997.
And I guess the single subject rule has been a conversation from that time till now?
Chairman, that's correct. It's always brought up by legislative affairs. They feel they have to bring it up. And they're just being very thorough.
And has it been actually challenged in court to date?
Not in this area. No, sir.
All right. That was going to be my question, to find out if we'd actually have it, had it tested anywhere. Okay. Senator Wilkowski, any questions?
You know, it's a risk. If they're willing to take the risk, then I'm not going to push it any further, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, no, I think we need to have the discussion here, because if it's estate planning generally. I mean, we call it the trust bill, but it really is estate planning, if I understand correctly. Is that true, Mr. Schaftel?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The state is planning is both pre-mortem and post-mortem, so the way we divide it up is estate planning and the state and trust administration. That's what happens after someone dies. We have to administer the planning.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that's a worthy conversation. And it would be wrong for me at this point to try to start running through a sectional, but here's what I intend to do. I intend to have a session just on this to go through section by section. Mr. Schaftel, if I have a committee meeting tomorrow, will you be able to be here and discuss some of that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'll do my best. I'll rearrange my calendar.
Committee members, any challenges? I will go and talk to the rest of the committee members. I think it's very important that we get an overview of this. Anybody here have anybody in this time frame have a time issue that needs to testify at this point? All right. I'm going to set this aside for tomorrow's calendar. Tomorrow's calendar, it would be the only thing that we deal with. So, and then Friday we'll pick up on the auditors. We have the Sea Otter bill coming before us. Senator Dyson?
Yeah, I have Transportation Committee tomorrow at the same time, 1:30 to 3:00. Looks like there's three bills up there.
All right. What do you have after 3?
I have 23 minutes free and then start resources on HB4 until 5.
Okay, well, I'm going to schedule it, and then if I can get other members here, fine. If not, we'll just cancel it. I don't have enough time for us to begin a substantive conversation today. I'm sorry about that. HB9 took up a lot more time than I thought, and in order to do justice of 65, I think I need to go through the bill. So we'll pick it up tomorrow. My plan is to at least have a quorum enough to gavel in, and then if I have to move the calendar down, we'll do it. Or if I just have to gavel out and pick it up again Friday, we'll do it Friday. So, is that okay? I mean, part of the problem is capital budget and House Bill 4 and the oil tax are going to suck the oxygen right out of this building. And that's kind of the thing we live under right now. So I will see if I can get a committee meeting together tomorrow. I'll have it scheduled for 1:30, and if we can move it around, or if I can take an opinion of those that could be available before that, then I'll try to get it before that. But at this point, 1:30. All right? Okay. Adjourned.